I think since Mr. Ray certainly went through a lot of experiences on his trip last time, I'm not going to repeat practically word for word what he told you. But I did talk to Mr. Malk about this a little bit, and I felt myself that the one thing you would be more interested in than anything else would be something in connection with our trip down to South America. While I was down there, I wrote four articles and started well into another one, three for the Good News, one of which you've read, I think, and another two will come out in this issue in a few days, one for the Plain Truth, which is already at the printers, and started on another one from Venezuela, which will come out in the following issue. And a lot of these things will come out in those articles. But I think there are some things behind the prophecies that are yet to occur in the United States as far as the way this is going to work out in the news, a clue or a key by which you will know exactly what is happening that I would like to give you in connection with this trip, and then mention perhaps some of the things we found down there. Mr. A, sir, must have mentioned to you that we're going to begin broadcasting down there, God willing, and if the way is really open, and we feel it will be, January 1st of 1958. And he's going to be doing the speaking, not me. I don't think I can devote full time to two languages. And if I did speak in Spanish, I'd have to drop all the teaching and the English work and speaking on the broadcast in English and just study Spanish and nothing else, because I'm not that good yet. I'd have to really put in full time in Spanish. So Mr. Ray is going to be doing that. I'd like to give you just some geographical points about it. Mr. Ray may have mentioned that we were farther east than New York. We would have been a couple of hundred miles out to sea farther east than New York as far as the coast here, Los Angeles, is concerned. So we were about 3,000 miles east of here. And we were farther south than the tip of South Africa. We were farther south, for that matter, than Sydney, Australia, which is one of the southernmost cities in Australia. We were on a line equivalent with just the very southern tip of Australia between Australia and Tasmania, or about where Melbourne is. And it was good and cold, as he may have explained. We wore sweaters, gloves of porcupine skin, hats we picked up in Chile, and big raincoats, and still we were cold. And Mr. A caught a cold, and so did I. Where we were in Chile, that is, in this particular part, the capital there, which is about halfway now, and then across in Buenos Aires, it is as far south of the equator as the Northern California area is north of the equator. Now, you don't even encounter the equator until you get to Ecuador, and that's a good ways down into South America. And then you continue on that continent an equivalent distance of going from here to Ecuador and turning right around and coming back to Northern California. Give you an idea how far down there that is. I didn't really realize it myself, but when you take it out on a map, you'll see that South America juts down much farther than Africa even. And it's a good distance down there. We didn't know how far we were going away from home, I guess. Well, now, one thing I'd like to bring out is this, that there are two definite keys you should remember in connection with the daily news, in connection with biblical prophecy, as to how these things are going to work out. Right now, it would be absolutely ridiculous, it would be naive of me to ever stand here and tell you, after a trip of just short of 4 weeks, that I know a great deal about South America. It would be equally ridiculous to tell you that South American people are going to band together and come up here and conquer the United States, because they couldn't do that in 2,000 years, I don't believe. Maybe in 2,000 years they might, because a lot can happen in that length of time. But God didn't give them the natural resources. He didn't give the people the same kind of ingenuity. He didn't put them in the same choice spot on the earth that he did the Israelites. So I'm not trying to tell you something like that, but I want you to bear in mind two principal things about how this is going to work out. Point number one is the chief factors now I'm going to give you that are going to cause our national downfall. The existing status quo of the United States, our present peak, and it's bigger than it's ever been before, of wealth and of prosperity, of individual prosperity and national prosperity, of all of our products that we're producing here in our industrial sections, is going to drastically change. That's point number one. Everything that we see now that has such an air of permanence about it, all of these hundreds of thousands of new automobiles that are coming out, new models every year off the assembly lines, our big factories, our Navy, Army, and Marine Corps, our big cities, all of it is going to drastically change. It's going to go down. That's point number one. I'll give you some of the reasons why and some of the factors that are going to bring it about in a moment. Number two, a vast worldwide trade combine, I say worldwide, it's going to originate in Europe, but it will be worldwide, is going to get a hold of us in a stranglehold that is going to cut off our economy, is going to cut off our trade, and is going to literally starve us to death. Now, I want to go back to point number one on the fact that our national resources are to be taken away from us. Some of the factors that are going to bring it about, I don't need to go over, except to just very briefly remind you of them. Mr. Hay brought it out in his article nearly 2 years ago now, remember. In 2 years, he said, disease epidemics are going to hit the United States. Now, what is going on right now? Just after Mr. Ray and I left Santiago, Chile, about half the population, and that city has, I think, somewhat over 1 million population, got Asiatic flu. Hundreds of them were dying. Now they expect, I think you've read the newspapers, and all the accounts vary, and everyone is either suppressing news or building it up in some kind of a frightening fashion. But at least the figure they gave us in the L.A. Times was that they'd expect an approximate 34 million cases of Asiatic flu in the United States this year. Now, the doctors say don't be alarmed because the death rate is something like 1 out of every 1,000 people infected. But I can tell you it's much higher than that, and they have been suppressing it. And also, a word comes from Chile that antibiotics, which were given those people in the first place and at the beginning of this onslaught of flu, was successful in warding off the disease to a certain extent. Later on, wore off, or else the flu was getting stronger. One or the other, they couldn't explain, so that they were still getting Asiatic flu. And their vaccines were doing no good. Now they're talking about vaccinating all the service personnel, the essential workers, and all the rest. And there is a pretty good-sized scare on, but at the same time, the newspapers and your radio stations are trying their best to say that we're prepared, don't get alarmed, we're going to meet it, and everything will be all right, you see. Now, at the same time in the United States, you may not realize it, but right here in the United States, we have in several counties in Texas, sleeping sickness. We have in several different locations in the United States, bubonic plague. We have yellow fever, sporadically, here and there. We have parrot fever. We have beriberi. Some of those diseases that were supposedly stamped out and haven't been heard of, you know, in this hemisphere at least, for many generations, and yet they are here. Now, you can take, for instance, the invasion by insects. Back around 1918, just after World War I, many of you may have read this article in the Reader's Digest about Louisiana's fire ant invasion. Well, it's more than Louisiana now. It's most of the South. And it listed all of the states there and the millions of dollars worth of damage up to, what was it? 80-some-odd, more than that, out of the number of counties in one particular state, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was South Carolina, almost 90% of the counties in the entire state had been affected by this fire ant. They call it a fire ant because it slits a little slice out of your skin with its head and then turns around and plunges a stinger in and into the open wound, rubbing salt in the wound, so to speak, and it's a very fiery itch. Now, this little red ant causes chills and vomiting, nausea, and sometimes aches of your joints and puts a person in bed for several days, and in some very rare instances even causes death. It has venom that is equally as serious as the bite or sting of a hornet or a bee, a little ant. Now, it's gone more or less underground. All of a sudden last year sprung up, and one wheat farmer, for instance, walked out, took a look at his wheat crop one day after a heavy rain. And after the rain, the ants are clearing out their colonies and their tunnels down here, so they're bringing up these little soft balls of clay. And they build ant hills. And their ant hills can be anywhere from a foot to 4 feet high. And here, all over his wheat field, for acres and acres, as far as he could see, the first day, were all these little yellow ant hills, about this high. 2 or 3 days later, they were so thick that he said, there's not one spot on my property a cow can lie down without lying on an ant hill. Now he said, how can I harvest my wheat? I can't run a tractor over it. I can't run a thrashing machine over it. Just breaks the blades. And I can't get rid of the ants. That land that was once prosperous wheat land is now just so much desert because there's nothing you can do with it. And it gave the figures in this article as to how many thousands of dollars it would cost to restore that kind of property by fighting these ants. And even then, it said, the only effective usage of the DDT and the sprays they use is for 3 years. It lasts 3 years, and then the ants come back bigger and stronger than ever before. See, the remaining ants apparently burrow down about 6 feet more until they can get enough strength and enough numbers to come back up again. Well, that's just one more little thing. Now, beside that, you've seen in the past few years all of these things breaking out in the United States, the various reports on the rising in diseases. There was a report the other day that 10,000 people in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, have been stricken with a new kind of virus they'd never heard of before. They've got a new kind of virus. One of our students, when I read that clipping last night in Bible study, is from Milwaukee. He said when he left less than a week ago, there were 700 cases in the city. And yet this article, printed 2 or 3 days later, said 10,000 cases. Now that sounds like it spreads pretty rapidly, whatever it is. That's one more little sporadic occurrence. Then you can take hepatitis. That's because of a residual amount of the building up of DDT that you get on your peaches, apples, leafy vegetables, and all the rest of the fruits and vegetables they raise by using chemical fertilizers and then sprays for the insects. And your liver begins to store up a little bit of DDT, and after a while you get a disease of the liver. It's called hepatitis. And people are dying by the thousands every year from hepatitis. That's a very serious disease right now. And the AMA is quite concerned about hepatitis, and they're having drives, and Jerry Lewis and the rest of them get on television and try to get a new fund, a new foundation, a new drive going to fight this and that and the other disease. Well, I'll tell you this. They've got so many different drives going and so many different diseases to fight that if you would give about $10 to each of them, you'd give your whole monthly wage to them. That's just where it's going now. Now, you know about multiple sclerosis. You know about muscular dystrophy, I think. You know about heart disease. You know about cancer. These are the things we all know about. And yet they're taking hundreds of thousands of lives every year, and they're on the increase. We haven't seen yet what the after effects of the salt vaccine are going to be, but maybe this year or next something's going to break out as a result of these very vaccines, and yet not one single case is developed. But these things are going to happen. Now you take that. That's what we're doing to ourselves, isn't it? We're doing that to ourselves. Then in addition to that, what is God beginning to do to us? Drought? No one can deny about the drought. The forests are so dry up in the eastern sections of the United States. There is no deer season this year. They won't let hunters go in the woods. And as a result of the drought, forests dry out. The animals begin to starve. They move down into lower areas, into the inhabited areas, where sometimes they contact rabies and begin going mad and biting human beings. Also, forest fires increase. So when forest fires increase, every Douglas fir, for instance, in Oregon, Idaho, or Washington, that burns off the side of a mountain, that means 1 ton of water that is stored in its taproot comes roaring down Oregon streams the next time you have a good heavy rainfall. So every year you have more forest fires, and then when your rains come, you don't have any watershed, the roots of the trees going into the sides of the mountains, so your floods increase. So we have drought. We have floods on top of that. Texas thought they were getting some rain a while back. And they got rain and rain and rain. First they prayed for rain, and then the same communities got out and began praying it would stop. That was in the newspapers. And they had floods. Then we've heard of Cameron, Louisiana hurricane. We've heard of all the many, many tornadoes and so on. Well, you can go on and on and on. Tidal waves, earthquakes, hurricanes, tornadoes, drought, flood, all those things in nature that God is bringing, then the insect pests, and then all of our diseases and so on. Now, it really is, it's difficult for any one of you to sit here and look me in the eye and tell me that you can conceive of people crawling on our courthouse steps, lying out here on the curbing, just like they do over in a city in India somewhere, with bloated stomachs, starving to death, dying of disease so fast that just like in Chile, every single coffin maker is almost completely out of business. He can't keep up with the orders. He's sold out. And they were waiting at the graveyards in long lines with their dead, sometimes wrapped in blankets or canvas, sometimes in cheap boxes, because the grave diggers, volunteer grave diggers, couldn't dig the graves fast enough, and that was just a week or so ago. Now we're going to see things just like that right here in the United States. That's this point number one. When this situation begins to develop, when it changes so much that our great prosperous United States is practically on its knees because of an internal situation like that, then we get to number two, what's going to happen. All right, a vast worldwide control of trade. Now, already we have the European Trade Community. We have NATO. We have the beginning of the relaxing of trade barriers between the East and the West. We have a little bit of commerce and trade of traffic beginning between Russia and the West, but not very much yet. Now, if you've read T.H. Teaton's book, Germany Plots with the Kremlin, you know the idea there of a possibility of a secret deal between Western Germany and Russia. That is a deal whereby the Western Germans will be given Eastern Germany and perhaps a part of Poland and perhaps certain other concessions in return for a non-aggression pact, which they want to get themselves, and then to open up this great trade route to the East so they can get all the raw materials from Mongolia, from China, from Siberia, and from Russia, and from all the Ukraine and so on, the industrial areas of communist Russia, in return for the manufactured goods of the Ruhr and Saar Valley, principally the Ruhr. That's going to be a pretty good-sized apple in front of the eye of the communists, and perhaps Adenauer has already engineered the signing of that deal when he went over there a couple of years ago. We don't know. But now what I want to dwell on for the remaining time is principally the tentacles of this World Trade Organization that are beginning to spread into other countries all over the world. Now, right at the close of World War II, GIs, bewhiskered, unshaven, and unkempt, went rambling into Essen and into the cities of the Ruhr in Germany in their jeeps, their trucks, and their tanks. They went to the home of one Mr. Alfred Krupp von Halbach und, what is the rest of his name? I've forgotten it all. What is it? You remember? No, it's Bohlen. Von Bohlen und Halbach. That's it. They call him Mr. von Bohlen over there, but we call him Alfred Krupp. All right, they clapped him in jail as a war criminal. He was let off, I think, on about half of the time. He was in, I've forgotten, let's see, which prison that was. Bamberg, I believe. And he was in the same prison with some of the other chief Nazi war criminals who were either hung or executed. And he was in the same one with Rudolf Hess, who is still there and may be let out in the future. Hitler's right-hand man. Now, this convicted war criminal is a very good friend of the United States right now, and we're so naive that all of our Western planners and politicians are just sure that Alfred Krupp has forgotten those 5 years in prison as a common jailbird. He is one of the richest men, not just in Germany. He's the richest man in Germany, hands down. He's one of the richest men, not just in Europe, because he's the richest man in Europe, hands down. He has more money than the Queen of England, I imagine. But he's one of the richest men on the face of this earth. But after the war, they weren't going to allow him vertical industry anymore. That is, to line up the industry from the coal mines right to the finished product, so there's no possibility of a strike. Now, some of our outfits in the United States have that. You might call it a monopoly. Well, you get vertical industry, and you line up your factory so that your coal miner works for Krupp. The railroad that hauls the coal to the factory belongs to Krupp. The factory that, and your coke and your cracking ovens and all the byproducts factories that make your nylons out of the coal and the rest belong to Krupp. And then when they take the coke to the blast furnaces to produce the steel out of the iron and so on, that belongs to Krupp. Right down to the finished products, anywhere from false teeth to automobiles, whatever it might be, it all belongs to the same man. Now, third, let's say, someone goes on a strike and they're in a little factory where they make a certain kind of a spring. All right, Ford is bogged down. He's got to have his springs for the cars. That little factory is on strike, so Ford is stuck. He can't produce cars. See what I mean? In this vertical industry, that never happens because the one man owns the whole thing. Now, they stripped away from him all of his verticalization of the industry in that they took his steel mill. They took his steel and his coal mill. But they let him have all of his manufacturing industry. So that Krupp, of course, is producing all kinds of equipment in Germany right now, but his heavy industry, locomotives, steel mills, and so on, they took away from him. But that's only in Germany. That has nothing to do with other nations. Now, how did Krupp solve his problem? All right, in India, he's building a steel mill. He's building locomotives. He's building railroads. In Pakistan, the same thing. In the Sudan, bridges, hydroelectric plants, railroads, steel mills, all the rest. In Egypt, the same thing. Let's see, in Yugoslavia, yes, Krupp men are developing and designing heavy industry and sending in Krupp material there to construct steel mills. All through South America, just dotted here and there, especially in Brazil and in Argentina, Krupp is building steel mills and heavy industry. Now, this brings back millions of Deutschmarks into Germany. Germany, right at this moment, is, in one way of looking at it, the wealthiest nation on the face of the earth, even more so than we are, for this reason, that their money is sounder. Their money is backed up by more actual gold reserves. It's harder cash than our dollar. Your dollar isn't backed up by as much gold over in Fort Knox as you may think it is. But the German mark right now is. Here we see now a logical situation, do we call it? Here was France. They're the victor in World War II. They won the war along with the United States and Great Britain. Here's poor France, bogged down in a rut, poverty-stricken, doing nothing, all befuddled in its government, having had I don't know how many presidents and prime ministers since the close of the war. But France won the war. And she is in debt to the European Trades Union, millions and millions of francs. Now here's Germany, poor thing, who lost the war, and whom people said would never rise in 50 years, and some even went so far as to say 1,000 years. And that same European Trades Union owes Germany many millions of marks. Does that make sense? That's the way it is. Now, Krupp then has spread his money out all over the world so that they are bringing foreign capital into these nations, developing their trade, talking about the nationalization of industry in these other countries, and yet it's all going back to strengthen Germany. Now, I'll give you just one little example. We helped them out the other day. By that, I mean we bought some German equipment up in the office. A little machine came out. It's something like one of these tape recorders. It's called a Sennheiser. It's about this long, about that high. It has little tapes. Now, that little machine with a little microphone does everything that three dictaphone machines, the Dictaphone Corporation put out. They're about that high, stand up beside your desk in a row, about that wide and about that thick. On one machine, you pull out a big tray that has a lot of big wax cylinders in it, and you insert the wax cylinders. It's a little older model. They do have some newer desk models, but you insert the wax cylinder, and then you put a recording head on it, and it'll record for 12 and a half to 15 minutes. It's susceptible to heat, to cold, to droppage, or breakage, or chipping, or cracking, or something like that. When you're through with this, you give it to the secretary. She takes it on another big machine and inserts it on this cylinder, puts the earphones, and with a foot pedal listens to it and types it off. When she's through with that, she goes to a third machine, and she has to shave this thing with a cutting head and give it back to you, whereby you're ready to record again. Now, this little corporation that was devised and thought up in Western Germany has been in existence for 2 years. Dictaphone is a corporation that's, I don't know, 50 years old, I imagine. Maybe not quite, but almost as old as RCA or any of the rest of them as far as office recording equipment is concerned, and was the biggest in the world. In 1 year, they seriously ate into Dictaphone, and in 2 years, they're outselling them. Dictaphone, when you get the complete machines, it'll cost you something like $1,200. I bought this one for $175. They're outproducing them, outsmarting them, and underselling them. That's a fact. In automobiles, any kind of machinery you want to talk about, the Germans are making it better and they're making it cheaper. And this is what it all means. Geopolitically speaking, the United States has been called the elephant with the mouse in the cage. I think I mentioned that once before. If the elephant decides to turn around and sit down, the mouse had better look out where the elephant sits. So the way we worked it before with Mexico and her cotton. You know, they've been trying to get a lot of irrigation in this state of Sonora down here, south and east of us, to get a lot of cotton to grow there. Egypt relies principally on its cotton. Now the United States tells its cotton farmers, you produce a bumper crop, we'll supply all kinds of subsidies for you if you're having a little rough go of it. Don't take a wide sweep on the corner. Go clear to the corner. Get every single last grain of that cotton that you can, every little ball of it. Fight the boll weevils. Produce, produce, produce. And if we can't sell it on the world market or use it ourselves, we'll store it in a big, huge government warehouse. And we'll pay you for it. The government will buy it. All right, the government buys it. The farmer produces, and he overproduces. Drains the land, and then turns it over and puts more chemical fertilizers in it and goes at it again. A few years later, we get too much. Now we've got billions of bales of cotton, and we don't know what to do with it. Here's little Egypt, and here's little Mexico. They've got their cotton, too. All right, now Yugoslavia needs some cotton. So do some of the other Balkan states. But Yugoslavia also needs American foreign aid and American manufactured goods. They don't get into that from Mexico, neither do they get it from Egypt. Egypt's got cotton for sale, Mexico's got cotton for sale, and the United States dumps 1 billion bales of government surplus cotton on the world market. Who do you suppose, whose cotton do you suppose they buy? Why, the United States cotton, of course. How does that make Egypt and Mexico feel? Well, this is obvious, but this is the way world trade works. All right. This situation has been going on for years and years. We have called the tune in world trade. We always have. We've made these other little nations jump and hop to get out of our way. We've called the tune. That's why they're suspicious of us. That's why they don't want our money. That's why when we give it to them, oh, sure, they stick out one hand and take it, but with the other hand, they've got a knife and they'd like to reach around and stab us in the back. They'd like to bite the hand that feeds them. Now, here's what this is going to mean. With Germany rapidly rising to this system, to this peak of power in Europe, with these old barriers breaking down, with the uniting of all of these nations in a common trade union, with the development of industry throughout South America, throughout Africa, and all over the world by these Germans, they are capturing world trade markets. People are beginning to do business with Germans instead of with the United States and Great Britain. Now, that's something that every world economist, every world tradesman already knows, and they're writing articles about it, and I gave you some excerpts from it in this coming issue in The Plain Truth. They're worried about it. They're frightened, especially the British people. They're very frightened. Now, for instance, I have a very striking statement from the president of the Industrial Union in Argentina that's coming in this next magazine article, in which he said that this European trade union, he said, it's going to hurt us when they do that because they're thinking about developing Africa. Oh, they frankly admit that. Developing the raw materials of Africa. The world's heaviest uranium concentrates, for instance, are found in the Belgian Congo. A lot of raw materials are available in Africa that the rest of the organized world needs. But they say, this will hurt us. They're going to develop Africa and bypass us. So the idea that they give you, and that this man frankly states, if you read it between the lines in his statements, his answers, which are in this magazine article, is that we stand down here in South America and we say, come on, anyone. Anyone who's got the money, who wants to build any kind of a mill, any kind of heavy industry, if you want to produce your automobiles, your trucks, your raw materials, or anything else here in our country, bring in your cash. We want to be developed. Now, who is it that's answering that kind of a call right now? Germany. Germany's answering that call. At this precise moment, most of the railroads, most of the airlines, a great deal of the heavy industry, of the automobile producing industry, Mercedes-Benz, DKW, Vamag, all the others, all of that heavy industry is owned in Argentina by the Germans. At this precise moment. That would be like saying Chrysler, Ford, General Motors, Union Pacific, Central Pacific, Northern Pacific, American Airlines, TWA, and a few of the others are all owned by Germans in our country. Well, that's the way it is down there right now. And they've been going in there since before World War I. Now, Krupp is able to receive President Kubitschek of Brazil, President Aramburu of Argentina, any of these men in a style that really befits a king, because he has a great big huge mansion just up off the Ruhr River, or the Rhine River, overlooks the Rhine River, where he can receive these heads of states and of nations in great pomp and ceremony. It wasn't very long ago, according to Time magazine, that President Kubitschek was over there. Mr. Ray told you, didn't he, that we drove out to this little town called Itu in Campinas. It was near Sao Paulo, Brazil, with the driver who had also driven Alfred Krupp out to the location where he is building a new steel mill. We took pictures of the warehouses there. They're old ones. They haven't been changed yet. Of the area, we saw where the bulldozers were breaking ground to begin building the company village. Because he builds the village and lets the people live there, you see, right next to the mill. The whole work, shopping centers, the village, the streets, the facilities of all kinds. It's right at a railhead, a double wide-gauge railway that runs all the way through Sao Paulo to Santos, which is their port city on the coast. And that is just one example. And before he goes into a country, he'll send all of his technicians there. And they go hundreds of miles back into the hills. They investigate the source of the raw materials. They've got to know approximately how many billion tons of coal reserves are there in the strata here. They've got to know about water power. They've got to know about, in other words, hydroelectric power to run this big mill. They've got to know about railway facilities from the coal mines, from the iron mines and so on to the mill, haven't they? Then they've got to know all about getting the raw steel into the other factories to produce automobiles and so on. You've got to line up the vertical industry from start to finish. Now, little do all these nations realize that all of these technical men, which Krupp supplies, which IG Farben supplies, which all of your big German industrialists supply to go along with their chemical factories and their equipment, are also agents. They're agents of German culture. They're agents of fascism and Nazism. And they infiltrate the communities. They have a great say in politics. Why? Why, because the majority of all the workers, the satisfied, high-paid workers, are paid by these men. Their livelihood depends on them. Hundreds of thousands of workers for the railroad, the airlines, the bus lines, the different kinds of trade unions which are controlled by Nazis. So the fascist party wants to get in? Well, why not? All the people vote them in. That's how simple it is. And that's the way it's working out down there. I'd like you to go now for a moment to one scripture which does help to bring out some of these things in Deuteronomy 28. Now, as you know, this is the parallel prophecy that goes along with Leviticus 26. And it was the Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, which were the two prophecies from which Mr. Hay gave these statements he made in his article about 2 years ago now, about these various seven-year periods of national punishment that are coming on the United States. Now, I think I did bring this out down here once before, but it became so much clearer even to me after going down there. But I want to mention this again, beginning verse 50 or 49. Let's begin verse 49 of Deuteronomy 28. The Eternal shall bring a nation against you from far, from the end of the earth, as swift as the eagle flies, a nation whose tongue you shall not understand, a nation of fierce countenance, which shall not regard the person of the old, nor show favor to the young. And he shall eat the fruit of your cattle and the fruit of your land until you be destroyed, which also shall not leave you either corn, wine, or oil, your raw materials, you see, being sapped away from you, or the increase of your kine, your cattle, or the flocks of your sheep, until he has destroyed you. And he shall besiege you in all your gates until your high and fenced walls come down. Now, of course, this was written in the language of the time. If, way back here, more than a couple thousand years ago, when Moses wrote these words, he had said, and he shall cause you to collapse through world economy and trade and so on, or use modern words in describing certain weapons and so on, no one would have been able to understand it up until now and all the way through. But it was written, of course, in the language of the time. Now, how can you besiege a nation in this modern day and age? How can you besiege a nation? Can you ring them with tanks and cut off their food supply? 13 years. So for 13 years, Nebuchadnezzar's army was outside of the city with their wives and their children, living normal lives except for the time that they were up there hurling all these stones at the wall with their big machinery that they would make of that day, trying to pound a hole in it. For 13 years, they kept hurling rocks until finally they knocked a hole in that wall to go through. That was a siege. But nowadays, they can't do it that way, so the kind of a siege God is talking about here is the kind that is going to end in the same result, and that is to starve us to death. Now, we have to sell our equipment overseas because we're not self-sufficient, believe it or not. The United States isn't, Germany isn't, Argentina isn't, Great Britain isn't. There's no nation on the face of the earth which is self-sufficient. That's what every nation aims at through its colonies. That's what every nation wants to achieve, is self-sufficiency, so that it can produce everything it needs, its defenses, anything that it desires, without having to trade, to deal with, to even bother with any other nation on the face of the earth. But there's no nation that has that. Complete self-sufficiency. We must sell manufactured goods to other nations to get certain raw materials. For instance, a great deal of our oil comes from other nations, from over in Arabia, from areas like that. You may think that our Texas fields are going to last us forever, and our small California fields, our Oklahoma oil fields, but they won't. And our industrialists know that, and so they do not even try to depend on them for all of the United States oil. In the meantime, we're selling oil abroad, sure, and we're taking in oil at the same time. It doesn't make sense to me either, but that's the way they do things. So we're not completely self-sufficient at all. Certain kinds of raw materials we need for our industry, which are not indigenous to the United States. They must be either mined or produced in other places. And in return, we sell the nations from which we get the raw materials manufactured goods. Now then, let's picture it then a few years hence the way it is going to be. The United States is down on its knees with internal trouble through all kinds of strikes, having hundreds of thousands of peoples dead from disease epidemics, from the attack of animals, raging race wars in many of our major cities and even in the countries, so that we're having so much internal trouble, we're not able to bury our people fast enough. We're becoming not the great nation that the whole world fears and looks to for world leadership and guidance anymore. We're becoming a third-rate power by this time. Here is the United States of Europe, and possibly the United States of South America, which I feel is very likely to happen, not including perhaps a few of the nations, but including many of them. I wouldn't state that dogmatically, but I feel it's likely. And here is Europe coming up with its 450 million people, all of the barriers broken down, and the usage of trade embargoes begin. In other words, now the United States formerly had said, you buy my cotton or else I won't give you my manufactured goods. Now then, Germany is able to say the same thing to the other nations to keep them from dealing with us. We can't sell anything. We can't buy anything. We are under a siege through a trade war. Now that trade war is going on right at this moment. It has been for many years. And if our people would wake up at this moment, I doubt very, very much if they could possibly stop it. I don't think they have the know-how to stop it right now. I think it's gone way too far for them to stop it, even if they would try right now. All right, he says, he shall besiege you in your gates until your high and fenced walls come down, wherein you trusted throughout all your land, and he shall besiege you in all your gates throughout all your land, which the Eternal your God has given you, and you shall eat the fruit of your own body. Here is a time of starvation, when we can't get food. Our own food isn't fit to eat. It's being destroyed, and we can't get food from other nations. So it amounts to the same thing. It is a besiegement. And you shall eat the fruit of your own body, the flesh of your sons and of your daughters, which the Eternal your God has given you in the siege and in the straitness wherewith your enemies shall distress you. Now this ties in with so many other prophecies back in Jeremiah 30 and 31. In Ezekiel 4, 5, and 6, those three that tell about a third of our population dying of starvation and disease, a third being destroyed, the remaining third being scattered throughout these many nations. Let's investigate some of the things that are going to bring about the attitude of these people toward the United States, some of the concessions they want from us, some of the injustices that we have perpetrated on South American nations, for an example, since that's principally what I'm concerned with now. Let's take, for an example, Panama and Colombia, very briefly. You can look up in any encyclopedia, in any history book, the exact truth of what happened about the Panama Canal. I think you know about the French lobbyists that were in Washington trying to get us to put it through the St. John River from Lake Managua, over to the... In other words, a sea-level canal without any locks. It would have been over comparatively low ground. If you've ever seen a map of the area, that's a very meandering river, which means at once it's not a very steep or a fast-running river. It means it's slow, and it means it's going down fairly level ground. And you can see there's just a little narrow strip of land that separates the shores of that big lake from the Pacific, and then the lake drains into the Atlantic in a very shallow, slow-running river. So it's practically level across there. That would have been the ideal place to build a canal in Nicaragua. But they sold the American politicians, who were gullible souls, on the idea that it should be in Panama. The French rapidly broke down. They failed to put through the canal. So we took up the work. But just as we did, President Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, had his big stick policy, you know. Certain American filibusters went down and started deliberately a war to cause the Isthmus of Panama to secede from Colombia. That was all the Empire of Colombia then, the Panama Isthmus and all of what is today Colombia. That belonged to the nation of Colombia. All right, those people began to secede. They began to fight. Teddy Roosevelt promptly dispatched an American battleship with a contingent of Marines and steamed it offshore back and forth and scared the daylights out of the Colombian. About 2 days later, after they ran up the Panamanian flag in Panama City, Panama was recognized by the United States of America as a separate independent republic. We were the first nation to recognize. Now, we were building the canal. You say, this is legal. This is the way things are done. This looks very good to the Colombian people. Well, ever since, we've had trouble with the Panamanians. They've got lobbyists in Washington right now and have had for 15 years trying their best to get control of the Panama Canal. They've been trying for years. I imagine Nasser's seizure of the Suez Canal gave them a good deal of hope. And I imagine also that our gradual concessions, which you can read of if you want to take the trouble to investigate it, on the revenue that canal brings them through the years, have given them encouragement as well. Well, the canal isn't quite as important today as it once was because of air travel, but it is important nevertheless. Not only does Panama want it, not only does Panama hate the United States, and I've been there and I know how those people feel, but Colombia hates the United States because they feel Panama shouldn't exist as a country. And the canal rightfully belongs to Colombia, and I've talked to Colombian businessmen who have said that. That canal is really ours, and you stole it from us. Belongs to us. And we're going to get it back someday, what is more. So, Colombia wants the Panama Canal. When we got to Chile, when I got there, Mr. A had already been there. He may have told you about the American fleet that came down to Valparaiso. That's their port city, about 70 miles over a small range of mountains away from Santiago. Any of you who have been in the Navy know what I mean when I say that there was a summer cruise of midshipmen on board that fleet. So immediately you know what was happening in Valparaiso and in Santiago, Chile. Here were all of these college kids, and that's all they were, with shaved heads, and the Navy had given them a mothball, taken it out of mothballs and given them a nice uniform that looks frankly silly to anyone who's been in the Navy, has anchors on the collar. It looks kind of halfway like an officer, but yet not quite. And any of the regulars make fun of the midshipmen, of course. Well, they're nothing more than ROTC members who've signed up for the ROTC in college, and they've taken that just like they'd take biology or any other class, only they've gone out and marched once in a while. Then they put them on U.S. Navy ships. The battleship Wisconsin, the aircraft carrier Essex was there and left just before we got there, a couple of cruisers and about seven destroyers. And they send them to some place like down to Chile. They're cruising around, and they put into a port. Well, now every one of those men, 17, 18 years old, away from home for the first time, is wearing a Navy uniform, going to a foreign country where they speak a different language. He's bound and determined that he's going to raise so much hell down there that he's going to be able to dawdle his grandchildren on his knee and tell them about it. He's going to really stir up a fuss in Chile. And believe me, they do it. They really do it. Now, when you walk down the street, and you hear the conversations of the people in Chile about our American servicemen, it makes you shudder. When you see the headlines of the newspaper, Mr. Ray may have even shown you some of the clippings he brought back. American sailors invade Chile. Now, maybe that's humorous and maybe it isn't, but I don't think they see altogether the humorous side of it. And so it went. Well, just before that fleet pulled in, the bottom dropped out of the exchange rate between Chilean pesos and American dollars. Those sailors weren't able to purchase anywhere near as many Chilean pesos for American dollars as Mr. A had been able to 2 or 3 days before they landed. Immediately after they left, it went right back up to the regular level of exchange again. Now that was just so obvious that you could see it. The clothing prices, all of that sort of thing, that didn't change any. But all of the restaurants, the drinks, everything like that, the prices went sky high for about 6 or 8 days during the stay of these American sailors down there, American college boys. Well, that's just one more thing. That really does make them hate us a great deal. Chile wants development of its nitrates and of its coal. It has a good deal of lignite, soft coal down there, and it's so heavy in the air as we would walk down the street, it would just settle on your coat and getting your nose and getting your eyes. Very sooty. There was usually a low overcast. It was very cold. And buildings are so antiquated, mostly, they have the old coal furnaces. And they're just belching all this black smoke, and it's just going up a few hundred feet and dropping all the cinders back down on the city. And it's a very dirty city. It's a very poorly lighted city. And they didn't have any heat even in the hotel rooms, in the lobbies, or even in the restaurants. So you'd follow the Chilean custom of drinking a little wine with your dinner and eating a hot bowl of soup to keep warm. And at any rate, we gave them $26 million just after Mr. Ray and I left the country. The United States invested $26 million in two private coal mining concerns. Both of them belonged to America in Chile. Now, it was the Haber process during World War I whereby the Germans invented the idea of taking nitrogen from the air. Germans have a great deal of ingenuity. Well, They used to have to mine it or get it off the ground. Chile's desert up there, the northern part, is literally white with the nitrate. They can use it in manufacturing nitrogen, of course, and in the nitrates, and also they use it for fertilizer a great deal, chemical fertilizer. And so they want those two chief industries developed. They have a great many rivers. They're very short, but they're very big and very fast. They come rushing down out of the Andes to the sea. They have the longest coastline of any country in the world. They have a great deal of possibility for the development of hydroelectric power, therefore, which is going to supply the current to light their cities and cause their industry to get underway. And they want foreign development. Now, Chile is a very poor country, very, very poverty-stricken country. It's not very important, really, in the scheme of world affairs, but it's just another little country that hates the United States. It's got a good reason to hate us. In Argentina, the story is quite different. Argentina is the 10th nation in size, trading nation, on the face of this earth. Stacks up number 10, ahead of a lot of other nations, and you might be surprised which ones, in the way they line up. Argentina's industry, as I said, is almost entirely controlled by the Germans. They have whole school systems, and I can give you some quotations, which I intend to in a later article in The Plain Truth, from books which are written by responsible news analysts and ones who have even been in Bonn, Germany, and who have lived there for years, a Reuters correspondent and others, who will frankly tell you that there are school systems in Argentina where all of the teachers are Nazis, and they have to walk in and a picture of Hitler is on the wall, and the morning greeting is not the saluting of the flag, it's Heil Hitler. That's in Argentina where this is going on. The same thing in Brazil, the same thing in Colombia. It's all over down there, that kind of thing. Now, I'd like to mention just a little bit about the population there of 19 million people in Argentina. Not very many as far as the size of the country. The population isn't too dense, and the real main part of the population is right around the capital, Buenos Aires. 97% are Italian and German with a little part Spanish, but mostly Italian and German and then a lot of Spanish. When I say Spanish, I don't mean Mexican. I mean people from Spain who are also fascist and have fascist tendencies. The remaining 3% are made up of Indian and other odds and ends of other kinds of people. But you don't want to overlook the Italians in the scheme of things, because Italy, of course, is one of the main nations in the coming Union, and in fact is the one which is going to give the name to it, the Holy Roman Empire. And Italy, the Italians are very thick down there. Mr. Ray may have brought that out about the Italian industrial families and all of the factories that are down there by the Italians. That is more of a European colony by far. The people are just as white as anyone else. They're just as light. They're not dark people. They're not the brown race. They're the white race down there. And they have just as white or light a complexion as any one of you. Now, in Brazil, when we got there, I'm making this very short because I think Mr. Ray covered a great deal of it. As I said, we got to Sao Paulo and we took that ride out to where Krupp is building a steel mill. We went through a lot of other industrial areas on the way, mostly belonging to Italian concerns. And I was amazed at Sao Paulo. That is a city that looks just like a New York, only on a smaller scale. Great big, you'll see some of the slides we got. We got some beautiful pictures. Big high skyscrapers all jammed up together, just a teeming industrial city. That city is 14 years old. It's all practically new. Those buildings are all practically new. It must be fabulously wealthy. And the hotel where we stayed was full of Germans. The chief restaurants were always full of Germans. We heard far more German being spoken down there than we heard English. We heard the two languages mostly, Spanish and German, and once in a while English. But that was it. We heard German in the hotels and the restaurants and wherever we would go. And most of the principal hotels have Germans who will be the clerk or the head waiter in the restaurant. And they'll make sure these German businessmen who are looking around to see where they can best invest their money in these countries are really well taken care of when they come down there. We saw a great deal of that as well. I want you to look for something in Argentina in the news in the coming months. There is a possibility that this man Frondizi, that Mr. Ray may have mentioned, F-R-O-N-D-I-Z-I, who is a fascist. There's another fascist, F-R-E-I, Fry, in Chile, who is a right-wing, an extremist right-wing party, who is running for the presidency there, who in all likelihood will be in before next year. I think the elections are due for February down there. They just had some elections which had to do with the Congress after we left. Now, if the right-wing parties, the radical parties, get in control of the Congress, here's what Frondizi will do. If they can get a majority of seats, they can win just by a bare majority there, barely over 50% of vote. He will have his right-wing members in the National Congress vote itself illegal, vote the Congress illegal, and disband. And that will leave just the one man, Frondizi, as the absolute dictator where Perón once was. Now, that's very likely to happen. I don't know if that'll be exactly how it'll work out, but it's very likely to happen in Argentina within the next year. At any rate, just because Juan Perón got kicked out, and it's possible, of course, that Perón could go back because there are plenty of people that want him back, and we saw posters splashed all over the city about Perón, you know. And he was very a very good supporter of the Nazis. He openly said he was. He was an ardent admirer of Hitler and his tactics. He had top Nazis down there to develop his army and his air force for him. Rudolf Galland, who was a chief German Luftwaffe ace during World War II, he shot down 102 Allied bombers and fighters. 102, that's an awful lot of dead American aviators there. This man developed the Argentine Air Force, and just a couple of years ago went back to Germany, where it's rumored that he is going to be the head of the coming German Air Force once again. The same thing is true of their army and of their other military organizations. They march and they look like Germans down there, in their the way they march and the kind of uniforms and the whole setup. The military organization of Argentina is literally fascist. Juan Perón made no bones about ultimate plans for uniting South America against North America. He made no bones about his idea of bypassing the little country of Uruguay and of taking over Brazil. And if he can get Brazil, which is bigger than the United States anyhow, and which has a tremendous raw material potential, and Argentina, which is already heavily industrialized, and unite the two of them, he's got a good start toward the United States. All that remains then is just a few little border countries around. You have the major part of South America right there. That was his ultimate plan. At this present time, he's still in Caracas, Venezuela, and we were there, you know, we didn't talk to him, but he was there in the same city, at any rate, while we were there. Well, those are just some things that you can look for. I don't want to take too much time on the particulars, because I think Mr. Ray must have covered a great deal of it, and I don't want to go over the same kind of ground that he did. Venezuela wants its own oil instead of American oil. We've got Esso, which is Eastern State Standard Oil. In other words, it all goes to Rockefeller. It's standard oil down there in Maracaibo Harbor, and all of the heavy oil concentrates of Venezuela are literally owned and governed by Americans. Venezuela right now is under Pedro Jimenez, who is an absolute dictator. It's an absolute dictatorship, just like Spain. When you drive along, you see an armed carabinieri or someone with either a carbine or a submachine gun at every major intersection, at every bridge, every railroad bridge, every tunnel guarding these highway and transportation facilities, just like it was in Spain. It's an absolute dictatorship, and you can just feel it in the air when you get to a country like that. Brazil would like to have development of its industry, as I mentioned, and freedom from U.S. coffee buying whims. Something happens, the dockyard workers go on a strike here, and Brazil is down and out, and their national economy is just completely stopped. You know what happened a few years ago about that, and how they had such an outburst down there that they were throwing Coke bottles through the U.S. Embassy windows and attacking the United States ambassador down in Brazil. Yet we go down and we sing songs about Brazil, and we say our tourists are having a wonderful time and we're all buddy-buddy. But underneath, those people hate us as much as any other country anywhere. Argentina and the United States put out almost the same identical product. Did you know that? Beef, hides, linseed oil, things like that. And for that reason, we are, of course, competitors. We're meeting head-on in world trade. Who do you suppose gets the favors? We do. Argentina doesn't. That hurts them. They don't like it. But now the Germans are beginning to develop them, and they're looking on the Germans with a great deal of favor. They're offering them all kinds of encouragement to come in down there. So what they want is national development of their industry, not foreign exploitation. And the Germans' methods of advertising, as Mr. Ray may have brought out, are totally different. We assure all of the people down there by posters. We were at an international trade exhibition in the city of Rio there, Rio de Janeiro, in Brazil. He may have mentioned that. And the American advertisements would say that we're going to be magnanimous enough to take all of your people who want to be a technician in the Ford concern and take him right up here to Ypsilanti, Michigan, in our big factory, and we're going to train him with American factory methods. We're going to put him through an American school. He'll be an American-trained man to handle an American-built car in Brazil. The Germans tell you in their posters and their advertisements that the Mercedes-Benz is a Brazilian car made by Brazilian workers from Brazilian steel by Brazilian, Brazilian workers for Brazilian drivers. And it's giving a great deal of money to Brazil. It all has to do with nationalization of the industry. There's not one word that's a German product. It's all talking about the nationalization. We tell them how good our products are and that we're being good enough to give it to them. And the Germans tell about the nationalization of the industry for Brazil. So there's a great deal of difference right there. Now, I'd like to go back for a moment and refresh your memory on the little forgotten book of Lamentations to show you, as I did once before, some of these scriptures and to help you read through this book of Lamentations in a little different light than you've been accustomed to. More than just Hebrew poetry, this little book, right past Jeremiah, is literally filled with very, very descriptive material about some of the sentiments of these countries and about the world situation that's going to be taking place just when these things really hit us in full force, just prior to and during the time when we're taken captive. So I want you to notice, right beginning here, it's a type. Yes, it uses Jerusalem as the type of God's people, but in many places it even brings out Israel as the whole tribes of Israel. Now don't forget, let's not be so narrow we think Israel is the United States. It's just a part of Israel. Israel is also Belgium and Luxembourg and Denmark and Norway and Sweden and Great Britain and Canada and Australia and New Zealand and the United States and all these other areas that belong to the Israelitish people. So this is going to happen to all of them, to all of us at once. In verse 1, how does the city, chapter 1, verse 1, how does the city sit solitary that was full of people? How has she become as a widow? She that was great among the nations and princess among the provinces, how is she become tributary, as if it's annexed to another great nation now, a very little importance. She weeps sore in the night, and her tears are on her cheeks among all her lovers. God calls foreign allies lovers in the Bible. She has none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. We have friends today all the world over, haven't we? International friends, or have we? Not really. We haven't a friend on the face of this earth. Have dealt treacherously with her. They are become her enemies. Judah is gone into captivity because of, and the words because of are not correct, but into great affliction, and because of great or into great servitude. She dwells among the heathen. She finds no rest. All her persecutors overtook her between the straits. All right, let's drop to verse 5. Her adversaries are the chief. Her enemies prosper. They're going up. We're coming down. For the Eternal has afflicted her. Yes, God has begun to take a hand in our nation. For the multitude of her transgressions, her children are gone into captivity before the enemy. And from the daughter of Zion, all her beauty is departed. Her princes have become like harts that find no pasture, and so on. Now, verse 9. Her filthiness is in her skirts. She remembered not her last end. As I mentioned before, the only reason for ever jotting down in a notepad anything that happened yesterday is to learn a lesson by your mistakes so you don't make the mistakes tomorrow. We say history repeats itself. All right? The world wars that we've had, the white man's burden. We went over to fight Drang nach Osten and all of the German slogans, living room to the east. The Germans wanted to push the Poles out into Russia. They wanted to kill all the Jews. So we fought the white man's burden, and we wanted to keep the Asians from saying Asia for the Asiatics, and we fought the war to end all wars. But we never remember our last end. We never learn a lesson from history, never once. We allowed Germany 500,000 men this time for an army, but after World War I, we only allowed her 100,000 men. It took them approximately 25 years, and she soaked half the world in blood again. Now, this time we allowed her five times as many troops, and we're stockpiling atom bombs in Germany, and we're giving them guided missiles. And after all, von Braun was the one that invented the V-1 and V-2, and we had him over here for years anyhow, as far as that's concerned. And Germans are the ones that are developing our intercontinental ballistics missiles. And I still say keep your eye on Lindbergh, and don't forget that. Lindbergh. You remember Lindbergh, old Lindy, the one that flew over to Paris. Why should Lindy get so much publicity? Other men have done things that have been equally as big in the history of this nation of ours. But yet you can't seem to forget the name of Lindbergh everywhere you turn. Every now and then an article comes up. Someone talks about him, his face gets in the paper, his name in the news, or else they make a movie about him or something. Now it came out that Lindbergh was granted a Brigadier General's commission in the Army. A few months later it came out that he'd been assigned to highly secret work on the development of the ICBM, the Intercontinental Ballistics Missile. Now he's a Brigadier General in the United States Secret Service, as it were, right now, working with these German technicians as the big cheese, so to speak, in charge of the development of this missile that's to go from one continent to another. So we'll see. We haven't learned lessons from history at all. Verse 12, it pictures the people as weeping out now and talking about the other foreign countries. And they say, is it nothing to you, all you that pass by? Behold and see if there be any sorrow like unto my sorrow, which is done unto me, wherewith the Eternal has afflicted me in the day of his fierce anger. From above he has sent fire into my bones, and it prevailed against them. He has spread a net for my feet. He has turned me back. He has made me desolate and faint all the day. In other words, he has just cut my strength. He's weakened me so much that I need your help. That's what the United States is going to say to Argentina, to Brazil, to Europe. And what do you suppose they're going to say? All right, they go on in telling how God has done it. Then verse 19. I called for my lovers, but they deceived me. My priests and my elders died, it should say, in the city, while they sought their meat to relieve their souls. Their nephesh is the word, their lives. Behold, O Eternal, for I am in distress. My bowels are troubled. My heart is turned within me, for I have grievously rebelled. Abroad, wherever my colonies are, you see, my far-flung areas, the sword bereaves, or war instruments. So my colonies are being stripped away from me, and I can't defend myself. At home, here nationally, there is as death, famine and disease and poverty and the bloated stomachs of women and children who are dying on the street. They, that is my enemies, have heard that I sigh or that I languish. There is none to comfort me. All mine enemies have heard of my trouble. We're coming down now. They are glad that you have done it. You will bring the day that you have called, and they shall be like unto me. Yes, ultimately they'll be brought down too. Let all their wickedness come before you, and do unto them as you have done unto me, for all my transgressions, for my sighs are many, and my heart is faint. Now there's so many more. It mentions Israel, verse 3, chapter 2 here, going right on down. He has cut off in his fierce anger all the horn, or the supply, of Israel. Talking not just about a city, but about 13 tribes, if you count the two, you know, of Jacob. And he has drawn back his right hand, of Joseph, rather. He has drawn back his right hand from before the enemy, from keeping them away from me, you see, and he burned against Jacob, that's another name for Israel, like a flaming fire which devours round about. Verse 14 of this chapter. Your prophets in Israel have seen vain and foolish things for you, your religious leaders, and they have not discovered or made known your iniquity, which means your lawlessness, because they haven't preached the law of God. They haven't discovered or brought to light your lawlessness. They've said you're good Christian people, to turn away your captivity, and that's the only thing that'll do it, but have seen for you false burdens and things to drive you aside, to draw you aside, as it should be translated. All that pass by now, all the nations, as it were, parading around and seeing our plight, clap their hands at you. They hiss and wag their head at the daughter of Jerusalem, saying, is this the city that men call the perfection of beauty, the joy of the whole earth? Is this that great United States where everyone has their own Cadillac, their two-car garage, their television set, and their five-room house with two baths? Now that's what it's going to become. Is this that great nation of all these gum-chewing, camera-snapping, loud sports shirt-clad American tourists who've been tromping through our little countries and talking about our quaint women who sit with their breasts exposed to the flies on a dung heap nursing their children? Well, that's the way it looks to those people when you go down and you see things like that. As I said before, the one real impression that you're always left with when you travel in a foreign country and come back to this United States is that we're so stinking, filthy rich here that we don't know what we've got. We really are. You drive down any freeway in this country and there's nothing like it on the face of this earth anywhere. Not even Hitler's autobahns are as nice. In fact, my brother mentioned that he showed a picture of this one joining of these freeways, about five ramps or whatever it is there, where your Harbor Freeway, the Santa Ana Freeway, the Hollywood and Pasadena and the Los Angeles and Long Beach Freeways, whatever they are, all come together there in Los Angeles and cross over each other. He showed that to a person in Britain, and they would not believe it. They said, that's a trick photograph. You haven't got any such thing. They wouldn't believe it was true. We don't know what we have. We really don't. And yet we gripe. We gripe and we grumble. Well, there's no other people on the face of this earth that live as well as the poorest of you, generally speaking. The poorest of you here have things in your homes, automatic washers, TV sets, radios. You snap a light, you snap a switch, and the lights come on. You have things like that in your house, an indoor toilet even, that people by the millions and millions all over this earth have never seen. A lot of people that I can tell you about right down in Chile and Argentina and Brazil would walk into your bathroom and see your toilet and think he should wash his feet in it. He wouldn't know what it was for. Now that's just a fact. A lot of those people have never seen a pair of shoes. It's not that bad in a lot of areas, that's true, but in some areas it really is. And we really don't see what we have. So it's no wonder they're going to look at it the way they will when they finally see. All your enemies have opened their mouth against you. They hiss and gnash their teeth. They say, we have swallowed her up. Certainly, this is the day that we looked for. This is what we have been living for. This is what we've been looking forward to all these years. Now, that's what they're going to say. Well, I'll break off there and just remind you that there is so much more of this. You can go all the way through Lamentations, especially the first, well, all the way through the fourth chapter, all the way through the beginning of the fifth chapter here, the whole book from start to finish. If you read it with this in your mind about the attitude of these other nations and the way the world's going to feel toward the United States when we're going down, it really opens it up and makes a new book of Lamentations to you. And it is a book about the prophecies of Israel going down. Verse 17, chapter 4, as for us our eyes as yet failed for our vain help. In our watching we have watched for a nation that could not save us. Talking about looking to our allies, to NATO, to all the other pacts, the SEATO and the other treaties, the Baghdad Pact and all the rest that we have signed and built up, trying to build a perimeter of defense around one enemy that isn't going to get in on the scene of our collapse at all. We're trying to contain Russia and build up Germany, and Germany's the one that's going to attack us. Well, I'll break off there. It's just exactly 3:30, which I think is about long enough so you don't get too tired and hearing too much all at once. I'm not sure who will be back with you next time, next week, but at any rate, we will have the schedule made out, and you'll be hearing from Mr. Raymond Cole from time to time and Mr. Dean Blackwell, who arrived on the campus yesterday. Oh, I remember one thing. I'll close with some announcements. One thing I wanted to mention, Mr. Malk reminded me of, was that we have, again, we said last year we had, but this year we have again, the largest class to ever enter Ambassador College, 55 new students this year. And that's indefinite. There are some that have not yet been definite, and there are some that are special students and so on. It may go over 60. And the total enrollment this year is going to be somewhat over 160 students. So that's getting up there for us. We're small, yes, but we're not the smallest anymore. But 160 students, as I was telling Mr. and Mrs. Mock today, is 40 times as large as the college was in its first year in 1947. Because it started with 4 students, and 4 times 40 is 160. So that's 40 times as large as it was when Mr. Herman Hay, my brother, Mr. Raymond Cole, and Miss Betty Bates registered as the first 4 students at Ambassador College. It's a real college now. It's got big classes bulging out so much, and as a matter of fact, that they're almost hanging out the windows in some of those classrooms up there. We don't have anywhere near the space we need because we can't use Ambassador Hall yet this year because of the Tabernacle building and because of so much funds, so much money having to be put into this building program. We have had to just cut off the building of the high school. We had to cut off the building of our new auditorium that we need so desperately. We don't have any room up there we can hold an assembly in where we can get them all in the same room. No room whatsoever in any of our buildings where we can hold an assembly where they can all see the speaker. We cut off the putting into the sprinkler system and changing some of the rooms around inside of Ambassador Hall. We cut off the building, the rechanging on the inside of that one building for our office. We've cut all of that off. We're concentrating on the tabernacle now. That has to be done first. So all the other is going to have to go, and we're going to have to rough it. Judy Malk here, who came to play the piano for us today, was just mentioning that she went up to talk to her sister and had to literally step around and over the bodies of some of our girl students in the halls in Mayfair. They're sleeping in the hallways this year. One girl's in the prayer room with all the brooms and the vacuum cleaners. Some others are sleeping in the hallways. And one girl told me the other night that she was given a bed and a sheet, and she liked to froze to death. Finally got up and put her clothes back on. Some of them are roughing it right now. But we're getting things in shape. We weren't prepared for quite that many students. We have a real crowd this year. But I think we can all rejoice in that. I know I am surely rejoicing in it. It means a lot more laborers. And 2 years, 3 years from now, a lot of you brethren are going to be hearing sermonettes from other men who are right now young, bewildered students who don't know whether the book of Hezekiah is in the Old Testament or not. So that does show you that Ambassador College is bearing fruit. And that's the important thing. All right, would you all rise and we'll have a closing song. Let's turn back to number 36. Blessed be the tithe. Sing the first thing, the first, second, and last verse.
We pour our prayer. is a hope, and a one for comforts and a cares. When we asunder part, it gives us inward pain, but we shall still be joined in heart and hope to meet again.
Just before we have the closing prayer, singing this song reminds me of one more thing. I'd like to mention to you, because I think you'd all like to hear a little about it, Dr. Meredith was finally given the news of his wife's death in London. Now, I think all of you were aware, of course, of it, and I'm sure that most of you, if not all of you, have been praying all the time about Dr. Meredith, that he would be given strength and help in overcoming this and in really being able to adjust to this new situation and to stand the shock, frankly, at his age and as close as they were. Well, Mr. Hay wrote a letter in which he said that a freak postal strike in India and a storm over the Himalaya Mountains caused them to alter their schedule in such a way that they missed the mail there, they missed the mail in Tehran, Iran, and they did not receive any word of it whatsoever until they got to London. Now that, I feel, was an absolute intervention for this reason. Mr. Hay mentioned that if Dr. Meredith had received that news at any time before he got to the London church without having that church group and Mr. Waterhouse and Mr. Longusky in more or less familiar surroundings in that one way, as an anchor there, that number one, he would have been over there in a foreign country where they speak a foreign language, completely out of his element. It would have been very hard to take. And number two, all that he has learned, the notes he has taken, the interest that he's had in the trip, would have been totally just valueless, I'm sure. He would have gotten nothing from it if he had received that news there. Well, in Gerald Waterhouse's ministerial report that came in this week, he mentioned in the report that it was certainly about the most difficult task, the hardest thing that he'd ever had to do in his entire life. Mr. Hay advised him to tell him privately, and he did call him into the office, and he talked to him and broke it to him, Mr. Hay said, very nicely. But of course, he was very broken up about it, and it took him about an hour and a half to 2 hours to pull himself together sufficiently to be able to talk to Mr. Hay and Mr. Longusky face to face again. But it was the following night that they had Bible study. Dr. Meredith was there with Mr. Hay, and of course, with this office routine, the British Museum to see, and they went right on in the daily routine that they had prescribed. The Sabbath services came along, and he talked to the London brethren for about 20 minutes on the particulars about the correspondence course. And just talking to them, being in Bible study and being there, helped him immeasurably, Mr. Waterhouse said. And he was very thankful that it worked out that way, so I feel that is certainly the answer to a lot of prayers. And I hope that you will continue to remember him, because we certainly do want to remember people in their trials. After all, some of us are going to be dying as the years go on, and then years here in the future yet, a lot of us who are even younger are going to be put to death or die in various ways. And this is, of course, a deplorable accident and only the beginning, but it is something that we need to remember, and I think we can all rejoice in that one thing. All right, I'd like to ask Mr. Jackson if he would lead us in prayer.